if you want to share it, we can share it. If not, then I'll just send you the video and you can do what you want with it. So
sounds great. Yeah.
All right. So the floor is yours. Take it away.
Okay. Well, if this gets posted, I've had a conversation with Paul previously, but it didn't get posted because there was just some things in there that were not mine to tell, I guess. But I will say that I've had a couple of conversations with, one with Jeff and one with Julian on the Randos channel that pretty well summarize my story, if anyone is curious about that. So I guess what I'd like to talk about today and just get your feedback and input on are, I'm in a stage of life right now where things have to be very embodied and practical. We live on a farm. I have three kids. I'm homeschooling them. And all that goes along with that. And we actually recently found out we're expecting number four.
Oh, congratulations.
Oh, thank you. So it seems a bit crazy, but you've had five, right?
Yeah,
so
I have five. Yeah.
And homeschooled them,
and
right?
Homeschooled them, yeah. Well, when you get a lot of kids like that, homeschooling makes more and more sense because at some point our kids did go into the public school system and we found that a lot busier. There were reasons why that happened, but when they were homeschooled, the schedule was our own. We didn't have all these demands. So yeah, it was good.
Yeah. And we live 30 miles from a grocery store. So in order to drive anywhere, to do anything, it takes a lot of effort and a lot of time. So yeah, it's been great. Even though I said I would never homeschool, I said that's something I'll never do. And here I am.
Oh, there you go. You got to be careful with those promises. My friend Rod Hugan talks about that. When he talks with people, he pays special attention to the little vows that we make.
Exactly.
Because they're powerful.
Yeah. So I was just saying I have about three or four main kind of points that I want to talk through that have really impacted me. Surrounding your channel and the whole Peterson movement and Peugeot and all of that. And then I have some questions that are kind of going to go along, hopefully on the tails of these main points. So again, like I need these things to be really practical. I have a tendency to live in my head, but I can't do it. And I think if a lot of these things stay in our heads, I don't think that there's a purpose to it anyway. I mean, it needs to be integrated and embodied. And I appreciate hearing other people's ways that they've been able to do this. So hopefully it will be helpful. Okay. So kind of the four points that I have here are, the first one would be just a re-enchantment of the world and experiences that I knew as a child, and just a reintegration of those experiences. And then the second one would be a fuller integration of Christianity into all areas of my life. The third is developing and cultivating meaning-making practices and how to go about coming up with those things. And then the fourth would be a community, just finding a community of people that are genuinely seeking this, you know, the truth, goodness, and beauty, and so many people that I've found through these avenues. So, just going back to the first one, the re-enchantment of the world, I feel like as a child, I lived in this magical world. I mean, I was one who loved fairy tales, and I had secret cubbies outside in the rock on the side of the house, and I communed with nature, and I fed the chipmunks, and it was a very alive, the world was alive. And as I grew older, I just felt myself distanced from that reality that shaped me so vividly in my young years. And it was almost like I went into this period of death and numbness where I wouldn't even, and it was, you know, a lot of it was going through dark times where I was struggling with figuring out who I was and what life meant, and going through struggles with sin and different issues that I was dealing with. But again, I just felt this distance from the enchantment of the world. And also through my church experiences, I started to become really skeptical of experience itself, because as I've said in other conversations, I was involved in a really unhealthy, charismatic type church where I noticed that people's experiences could be whatever they wanted them to be. And it seemed very, it didn't seem grounded in anything objective or anything that I could, link to a deeper truth. It just seemed like, you know, these feelings. And so I tended to drift in my views towards reason and towards, we just need to go to the Bible as the center of our authority and all of that, and which is basically the standard of most evangelical churches. That is the circles that I grew up in, especially in the last 10 to 12 years. So that seemed to be the path, and I seemed comfortable in that. But at the same time, I was just like, my Christianity was getting more, felt more and more dead. It's like, it's not integrating into, it's like this divide, this secular sacred divide was almost getting wider and wider. And again, that was not me. Like, I had this very enchanted side of me that was very connected to art and music and poetry and nature and all of that. And so I feel like I was losing all of that side of myself. But then after several experiences through our recent church that involved a pastor who I was on the search committee, and he ended up actually getting removed from the church. This was a couple years ago, forced out because of some views that he held that were based on biblical interpretation of a couple of passages. And so that whole experience really shook me up and made me realize that, well, okay, how do we rely on the Bible for these things when no one, even in the small circle of 100 people, can agree on what, you know, what this means? But, and then so coming through all that really pushed me into, as probably what made me find Peterson and you and Peugeot, and I'll get into what the integration of that fuller view of Christianity has meant. But I guess my question for you coming out of that experience is, now I've seen that it's like, it seems to me that reason, the role of reason in this whole journey has been to actually be able to look back on my experiences and use my reason to then know what experiences are in alignment with reality or with truth or the experiences that actually do, I don't know, put me in the right path, on the right direction. So I guess the question is, what role does reason play, and how do we decipher with all of these experiences that we have that seem like, I mean, to me, it's like, it's the experiences that have shaped my belief. It's not my trying to force myself, reason myself into beliefs. Like, that's just not how it's worked.
Right. Well, reason, I think it's helpful to remember what's primary and what's secondary, in that our faculty of reason is nested within the stories that we live within, but they are not siloed. They are, in fact, together. It's sort of like, a number of years ago, there was all this excitement when American evangelicals discovered what missionaries had been talking about with respect to bounded set and center set ideas. And you'll find a few videos out on YouTube of pastors excitedly talking about, we're not a bounded set church that has all these trip wires of biblical interpretation that if your pastor steps over, you know, the flash grenade goes off and you're toast. We are center set. Well, the truth is, center set and bounded set are always living in a dynamic interchange between the other. And this is similar to reason and let's say, the enchanted narrative that you discovered as a child and are longing for and want to live within. The difficulty is that the systems we live within, well, first of all, reason was never gone from that early enchantment either. There was always reason there. They were always working back and forth. So, and your reason continues to recalibrate your narratives. I mean, that's obvious from your story, because if it wouldn't, you'd have had this experience with the search team and getting rid of a pastor. And those things really tend to bother people because, of course, the structure set up is propagandized in a sense that this is a rational, ethereal certainty. And so when the pastor violates the rules, well, he's the pastor. He's supposed to be at the top of the hierarchy. He's supposed to be able to interpret the Bible better than anybody else in the congregation. So you have all these people who supposedly don't have the same theological education the pastor has, holding court against the pastor who's supposed to be the expert in this. And the whole system falls apart. Mm-hmm. And so it's helpful to understand the dynamic interplay between narratives and reason. Reason is this consistency mechanism by which we try to process things that are dissonant, and then we try to make them right. But all of the dissonance has everything to do with the narrative in which it's embedded. So these two systems are always interchangeable, and the fact that as a child, you reasoned like a child, you saw the world like a child, and then you grew up. Well, some of the childish ways in which you saw it had to give way, but you need a new play structure. You need a new narrative that now takes into itself what you've learned from reason. And so it's back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And dissonance is both the curse of it, because you long to live at rest in the enchanted world that you discovered, but and the dissonance keeps you from that, but the dissonance also forces you out into doing the hard work of recalibrating and updating your narrative structure to accommodate the new things that reason has discovered. And this is this question quest for the whole world. Again, the left mind mapped territory, unmapped territory idea very much maps onto this, because an enchanted world is a world that is secure, that is mapped enough to be secure, but unmapped enough to be enchanted. Mm-hmm. And so these two things are always playing against each other. And so you're always mapping the enchanted world. Well, once it gets mapped, well, now it's no longer enchanted. And then you look back at reason and curse it, say, oh, why did you ruin my world? And reason's like, well, do you really want to live in a world without reason? I mean, try being a schizophrenic. You know, that's how they live. No, you don't want that. You certainly don't want that for your children, because the minute there's a threat that you see occupying things that matter much to you, like your children and your marriage and your home and all of these things that are embedded with, boy, you marshal reason in a New York minute to engage the threat. And so this is the normal process of life. And yeah, it's a curse, because you don't get to live happily ever after in the enchanted world of your childhood. But if you had some kind of mental impairment by which you were unable to use reason and stayed in that enchantment, if one of your children had that, you wouldn't be happy with that either. You would want them to grow, develop reason, and begin the same struggle that you are wrestling with. That's my take on it, at least.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The
Feel
funny
free
thing
to push
is,
back on it.
No, well, I think about too, I've been very sure, reasonably sure about things that now I look back and say, I was, you know, completely deceived in that.
Yeah.
And so it just shows me the limits as well of reason. And again, when I think about my life and I try to recall what has shaped my beliefs, it has been these very profound, meaningful, embedded, symbolic, if you will, experiences. But again, I'm just, I guess my main question is how, because I could say that to someone and they could say, well, that's your experience. That's entirely subjective. So what do you think is the course for latching these experiences that obviously have great impact and influence on what we believe to some form of, you know, the highest truth? And again, I would, my cohorts in evangelicalism would say, well, does it line up with the Bible? And I would say, well, yeah, but I've seen problems there too. So
sure.
Yeah.
Well, I think the reason the Bible, and I've said this in a number of different ways, the Bible has a lot to say for itself, just in terms of, I mean, I often make a rational case for the primacy of the Bible in terms of guiding us in our world, because its track record of survival and durability is unmatched in human history compared to any other book. There's just nothing even close. Now someone might look at that and say, well, that's because of what? Because there hasn't been a hierarchical political structure that has actually larger than the Bible itself. You know, the Roman Catholic view is sort of that, well, the church is that. Okay, but the structural argument of the church is pretty weak too, given it how fractured it is. And so I don't know that we have anything better than the Bible. I mean, just in terms of when I look at it and say, okay, well, what would, so I listen to Brett Weinstein talk to Alistair McGrath and talk about, well, what we need something that's going to help us do wisdom between ancient and modern things. So what if we took like really smart people across disciplines and had them both become expert in their disciplines and have an integrative wisdom-based, text-based framework that could actually map across cultures, not only horizontally in terms of the cross-cultural frameworks we see today, but vertically in terms of almost all of the past structures. You're looking for that. You'd be really hard-pressed to find anything more useful than the Bible for that. Because you have a standard text that is not only mapping vertically across cultures and institutional religions, or horizontally, but also vertically over long periods of time. And so I look at that and I say, there's nothing else in the world that we have that is better than the Bible for acting as sort of a calibrator. Now, part of the problem is that what happened in the 19th century in Christianity was that Christianity looked at Darwinism and science and decided, oh, we need some of that. So we're going to start using the Bible as science, and we're going to start trying to make theology science. Mm-hmm. And that process died in the world wars of the 20th century. Almost no one writes systematic theology anymore, because almost no one, there are some people, because, and again, this is a feature, not a bug of the church, because you have all these latent groups that never give up on certain projects. And so the way I see the church, I mean, the church as Roman Catholic, Orthodox, Protestant, and the innumerable cultural, theological, philosophical diversity, that's it. I see it as this astoundingly useful organism that actually accomplishes a lot of what we need. Mm-hmm. Now, what this doesn't do is come to Sarah and give you a magic pill that suddenly makes, you know, everything go away or everything mm-hmm. happen, or because I'm not even sure we want that. Yeah. Because when we're in the role of mapped territory too much, as Dostoevsky notes, we start bringing a little bit of chaos into our life. And I bet you've seen that in your past too. So, oh, yeah. So I actually think that we don't have anything better than the Bible. And I'm really hard pressed to imagine us having anything better than the church to work through all those issues. But it is way more messy than we want. And God takes way more risks than we think he should, because we are tiny little centers of the universe that on one hand really want our children to be secure and happy and flourish, and our the little worlds around us to be stable and life-giving and nourishing and full. But at the same time, we don't want that to just become too boring and rigid and tyrannical. And you've tasted both.
Yeah.
And so you're like, well, surely we ought to fix this. And it's like, we probably won't, not in this age. Uh-huh. But I look at the Bible and I think, when I think about the challenges that we have as Homo sapiens and what we need to look for wisdom. I was listening to a podcast that Verveke did that he sent me. He said, I mentioned you in this. And I was listening to that podcast and I was listening to him map out what he wants for, I mean, you said a whole bunch of it, truth seeking, cultivating wisdom, cultivating meaning, integration, reenchantment. I listened to that and I thought, this is exactly what the church has been working on for 2,000 mm-hmm. years. Now, we don't have it right, but that, in fact, the Bible keeps telling us and suggesting to us we're not going to get it right. If you closely read the book of Acts and the letters of Paul, you realize that, now I'm going to get in trouble saying it this way, you realize that this lauded New Testament church in many ways was a shit show. I mean, the Judaizers and you read the books of, you know, the two letters to the Corinthians. It's a mess. And you've got, you know, the original Jewish apostles in Jerusalem, and they're worried about, gosh, these Gentile churches, what are they doing? And Paul is like, no, we've got the real gospel out here. You know, you Judaizers should go and castrate yourselves, and on and on and on and on and on. I mean, it's the contemporary church has nothing on them. It's a mess, but I think it's actually in the process of this mess that God does all of this amazing stuff. And again, I don't know any two better tools than the church and the Bible. Mm-hmm. And it's no wonder that the Protestants and Catholics just, you know, that's one of the main clashing points. What's the relationship between church and Bible? Well, that's a really hard thing. So yeah, I talk too much. Go on.
Yeah. And I think that is what I'm wrestling with right now. Because again, I've seen people take the Bible and do whatever with it. I mean, and that's how many different cults and sects of Christianity that we would consider heretical have started, as you well know. I mean, it's like, we're going to go back to the Bible. And so I just see this need to have the integration of tradition and church history, which I feel like, and this, I can move on to my second point with this segue, just the integration of Christianity. It's like, I look back at my church history, and it only ever went back so far. I mean, when I was a child, we weren't taught church history. I had maybe heard of Calvin. I mean, and maybe heard of Luther, but that was about as far as it went. And so the evangelical or even the Pentecostal type models that I was raised in didn't seem to have a fullness that I felt in my heart and what I was looking for. It didn't align with what I saw as the church, which to me, the hands and feet of Christ were seen in relationships. They were seen through people, individuals who, you know, were, you know, did things in my, for my family and for us as, you know, as people through difficult situations that showed us the church in that way. But as far as the system or the model, it just didn't seem to click. And so through really only within the, it's really kind of embarrassing for me to say this, but I mean, until a year and a half ago, I mean, I wasn't even really aware of the different, I mean, I knew of the different denominations, obviously, but you know, Catholicism was always kind of pushed to the side. We're not really sure that they're Christians, you know, that sort of arena. I had no idea what Eastern Orthodoxy was. And so through digging into all of these different aspects and dimensions of Christianity, I've realized that everything I've been looking for, it's there. I feel like it's all within Christianity, but it's just challenging, especially in the small town, kind of rural Midwestern, you know, evangelical church that I'm still attending to this day, to try and explain or integrate some of these things when there's still so many boundaries and still so many walls that are put up between something that sounds Catholic or something that looks this way or that way. And I've struggled because some of these things have been really, really meaningful to me and helped me actually realize that Christianity is the center that I want to focus what I'm doing around.
Well, you're trying to figure out what Christianity is, which is the difficult part of fuller integration of Christianity to all areas of life. What on earth is Christianity?
Yeah.
I mean, that's your question, because now you've begun to realize that, oh, so the Pentecostals, what do they do with church history? Well, there was the Holy Spirit was given, and then there was the Azusa Street revival, and, you know, off we went. So, well, there's no history in that. You know, there's a certain reading of the New Testament, and then bang, off you go. The Dutch Reformed Protestant tradition I grew up in was sort of like, there's the early church, there's the Protestant Reformation, which regained the early church. You have 1,500 years of blankness, and then off from there. And now the Orthodox, well, they tend to have, you know, okay, so the first 1,000 years or so of church fathers, they integrate that. The Roman Catholics tend to have, okay, you have Augustine and, you know, on from there. So you have basically the fall of Rome and on from there in terms of their history. So yeah, your experience is completely understanding and understandable.
Well, and I too, you know, I think of you and even someone like Julian, who has grown up with generations back in the same tradition, and in yourself with Christian Reform. Like, I kind of feel like a nomad because I was moved from this to that, never felt at home in any of them to, you know, whatever degree. It doesn't go back generations. I mean, I guess you could say general Protestantism, evangelicalism, but there's really nothing I don't know. I mean, it's hard to tie that to something, which is another reason why discovering and looking into Orthodoxy has been so intriguing, because I feel like, oh, there's something here I can grasp onto. And yet at this point in time, we are attached to the church we're in. We're in leadership positions there. It doesn't make sense for us to just leave the relationships and go, even though my husband and I are very drawn, you know.
Sure.
And if it wasn't for a lot of things, we probably would go, and who knows, eventually. But I guess too, it's just like, it seems all of these traditions claim to be the one. And, you know, stepping back and looking at them all, I'm obviously drawn towards certain avenues as being, you know, more true. Would you say that, I mean, is there a hierarchy within Christian denominations? It seems like it to me. And if there is, I don't know.
I think, and everything from down is down from there. I mean, that's right. The way human beings are. We're all like that. you know, and so I've worked a lot with church planters for whom these guys actually try to reinvent Christianity with every brand new church in the Protestant mm-hmm. world. I mean, they really yeah. do. And it's a fun thing to watch, but you know, so you grew up in Texas, right? Mm-hmm. Here's something, here's a much more recent historical fact that, so you have the Puritans settling in New England, you've got tobacco, you know, this great viral drug that births America in the southern states, and then you have the 13 colonies that cling, and they're all trying to, you know, the British are trying to tell the American colonies, don't go over those Appalachians, because we've given all that to the Indians, so just stay over here, and people aren't going to be contained, and so they start to leak out, and you have the American Revolution, and so what happens is that, I mean, it's just so many things. You have politics and religion and culture, all this together. Well, settlers fill up the rest all the way to California over the next number of decades. And none of the church structures that basically tried to be reduplicated on the East Coast from Europe could follow them. And so what happened was the Bible, in the absence of church, the Bible became everything, okay? And lost its historical roots. And then that happens at the same time that we begin, that we're in this ethos culturally of scientism. And so then the Bible, that in a sense, that shapes how everyone west of the Appalachians views the Bible and how they can organize themselves around church, which leads to this phrase, you know, someone goes out and say, well, be a Bible-believing church. Well, right there you have the root of American evangelicalism. Mm-hmm. And what you've just described in terms of your background makes perfect sense in the light of that history, okay? Mm-hmm. And what mm-hmm. you said about your relationship with you and your husband in the church that you're in, that makes absolute sense. I mean, people, because I do all this talking on YouTube, people, well, is Paul too soft on the Orthodox? Or, you know, when's Paul going to become Roman Catholic? And it's like, Paul's not going anywhere. Paul is, you know, third generation in Dutch Reformed. Paul's great-great-grandfather was a Jew. I have no idea why he had switched or even if, you know, who that was. And so in other words, you've got to make all of this stuff work in your life, which is full of particularities. And mm-hmm. actually the learning that you're doing and the growing that you're doing now, although frustrated, is actually part of the maturing of the actual body of Christ you and your husband are currently now established in. Mm-hmm. And Christ is himself the church. And mm-hmm. so the Orthodox Church in America, boy, you know, you can understand how for many people who have been impoverished of church and only have this particular use of the Bible, Orthodox Church in America looks like, boy, a breath of fresh air. These people yeah. have history and roots and traditions, and it's rich and it's full and it's symbolic and it's coherent and it's philosophically oriented, and all of this makes perfect sense. But, you know, so you visit the Orthodox Church and like, oh, this is amazing. And you get all these immigrants saying like, yeah, it's always been the same. You know, it was the same in the old country. We do it. The children of the immigrants are like, I'll never give up on my church. It's my lifeblood. Well, that's what the Dutch immigrants said when they brought their church. So it's a very understandable cycle. So now mm-hmm. you're in a liminal space. And in some ways, you know, you are blessing the people that you are actually doing church with now by your discontent, if you can figure out how to make that discontent productive.
Yeah. And I feel that, and I acknowledge that for sure. It's just frustrating.
Yeah. I'll tell you what's more scary is getting what you want, because yeah. I see it all the time. These church planters, like, I'm not going to name his name, but good friends of mine who are church planters, and they're planting a Christian Reformed church, but it's sort of Orthodox, and it's sort yeah. of, you know, we're doing weekly communion, and we've got the baptismal fount here, and we've got all these liturgical practices doing it. Well, 5 years into that, they realize, you know, okay, they've had their dream, and
yeah. Yep. I mean, there have been so many opportunities. We could have just picked up and started a new one. We could have left over the past 12 years. I mean, we've had plenty of excuses. People would have not second guessed our choices. But at the same time, we have not felt peaceful leaving and have felt that we're supposed to remain for perhaps such a time as this. And, you know, I've started to try and slowly integrate some of the things that, again, have been very meaningful to me coming from other dimensions of Christianity. I have to do it very carefully. I have to be aware of the words I'm using and who I reference, and which feels just, ugh, I hate that. But but at the same time, you know, I'm aware that people get triggered and people have history with these things and all of that. So again, I'm probably answering my own question. But yeah, I don't know.
That's why we have conversations. We have conversations to answer our own questions.
Yep.
That's why we do it. So no, so let's run another scenario. Mm-hmm. You and your husband, you go to some little Orthodox church full of all bunch of other people who are working through the same stuff you are, and you're all in that church. And okay, but let's say all of that goes tremendously well. What, in a sense, you've also done is broken your own narrative. Mm-hmm, because mm-hmm. staying in the church that you're staying in and working through those issues in this church means that you're simultaneously working through this stuff within your own narrative, not just within this local body of Christ. And so yeah. you're doing the work you need to do. And mm-hmm. it's, well, you live on a farm. You understand what work is, you know. So the rice farmer that just passed away here, he grew up on a dairy farm. And, mm-hmm. you know, he told his son, you want to know the wonderful thing about rice? You don't have to wake it up and milk it every day. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And a dairy farmer knows that. The dairy farmer that was in the church I grew up in Paterson, New Jersey, he hated cows. He probably also loved them in another way. But those doggone cows, they need all this attention. You know, it's just like the pet that the kid gets. I want a puppy. Yeah, you take care of them. Yeah, we'll see how that goes.
My mother-in-law said she wrote in her wedding vows that her husband, my father-in-law, could never have animals because of that. I think her family, they had some cattle or something, and it just, you're tied. You're so tied to the schedule and everything. And yeah, crop farming is a lot more flexible.
Yeah. But that tiedness is so much part of it. That's, mm-hmm. I mean, we need to be tied to our traditions, to our families, to our places. If we're not tied in some ways, then we're sort of like the kite that gets untethered. For a kite to work, it's both got to have the kite part, it's got to have the string, and it's got to have a fixed point. Without that, what the kite does is just tumble across the field and destroy itself. And so we need that tied part. And there's always the tension in the string. And if you're the string is like, and the stronger the wind blows, the higher the kite blows. And the kite's like, whee! And the string's like, this really sucks. You know how hard you're pulling on me? And that's life.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay, so this is another question for you, talking about the Bible as the center. Do you think the Bible can be an idol itself?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And we see mm-hmm. that played out often. Mm-hmm. When the Bible, again, idol, icon, what's the difference? Icon's right. Supposed to see through. Jesus mm-hmm. is the icon, I'm quoting Greek here, of the invisible God, the book of Colossians. We are supposed to see through the Bible to the Bible's source. Mm-hmm. That's the whole idea of inspiration of the Holy Spirit. That's why theologically it gets tied there. Now, when we stop seeing through the Bible to its source and just divinize the Bible itself, well, now you're worshiping a book, and mm-hmm. we're not to worship a book.
Like, it seems like that sort of biblical idolatry is tied to trying to fit the Bible into this, you know, the very materialist, literalist type interpretations. At least it seems that way to me. It's like, I don't know. And this is the struggle that I have with a lot of evangelicalism, at least the more really conservative evangelicals that I've been around, is it's like, well, if we're saying that this is not accurate in the scientific way, then how are we to believe any of it is true? And I've just come to such a fullness of realizing that, that I don't know, it's like understanding the patterns and the symbolism, which when I say symbolism, I mean it in the Peugeot way of all the layers coming together, has made it seem much more real to me than the way that it was presented to me as a child in this very base literalistic way. And again, you know, I'm not saying we throw out the historicity at all. But it just, yeah, I guess it just needs all levels in order for it to actually be life-giving and not turn into an idol.
Every generation addresses the overreach of the previous generation. Mm-hmm. So the emergent churchers rebelled against the seekers, and the seekers rebelled against the fundamentalist literalists. And so we keep, and that's again, the intergenerational process of recalibration. And so I, you know, inerrant became this catchword for evangelicals fighting the modernists. And I always preferred infallible. Well, what does infallible mean? It means it's faithful. It means that the Bible is faithful to accomplish that which God has given it to us for. And it's for pointing us to God himself and shaping our lives. I've spent a lifetime interpreting the Bible and watching other people interpret it. And when I look at the literalist game, it's just a game, because literalists don't hold slaves and refrain from eating shellfish and use biblical anatomy. And I mean, because you just can't do this, and we know it. But so then the game is intended to do other things.
Right. But it's also funny. I see people that will interpret certain things this way, but then they'll come to a part that's problematic and say, well, that's a metaphor. Just like,
well, that's right.
Okay.
I get every now and then to ask to teach a class in like an evangelical school, and I'll put up the verse that says, you know, you have to confess with your lips and believe with your heart. And so I ask them, is your heart a believing apparatus in your body, or is it a pump? Mm-hmm. And what we mean by heart is, yeah, I get it. That's how language works. And saying this does not mean I'm very committed to respecting the Bible as history. But I also have an understanding of how history works.
Right. Right.
History has all the same issues.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Just us. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. and that's something that, and I, you know, I also appreciate the fact that I sort of like the analogy of the Bible as genetics and our lives as epigenetics, because the epigenetics decide which proteins to turn on in the genetic code, because most people have a very small Bible within the very large Bible. The culture itself wears it down, you know, says, oh, these verses are important. It's the stuff that people put on plaques in the Bible bookstore. That's the epigenetics at work. And you know, you can be dismissive about that dynamic, but it has to be, because just like the world is too complex and we have to figure out a way to shave it down, the Bible is too large and we have to figure out a way to shave it down. So we do that culturally. The church does that. We do that together. And actually part of why the Bible is so useful is because you can actually understand what's going on by looking at which parts of the Bible specific places and times are highlighted. And you can see this in the New Testament, which is in fact a reading of the Old Testament. And when Jesus keeps calling himself the Son of Man, he's doing something specific to a generation that really has its salience landscape pointing at Daniel 7. And the New Testament is full of that stuff. So this is not new.
Yeah, Nothing is new, so I've learned.
Well, a few things every now and then.
Yeah. All right. Okay. I'm going to move on to kind of my point number three, and that's just developing and cultivating meaning-making practices, or to use your terminology, I would say it could be glory-making practices. The stuff that Verveke's been doing is, in a certain degree, very fascinating to me, because the structures that he's wanting to build, I think, yes, that's what I want. But at the same time, I find him losing me, just because, and I've heard this frustration with many people. It's like, there's nothing, it's not built on anything. It's just what's the center here? Like, it just feels like it's a useless project if it's not focused on, to me, it would be Christianity, obviously, because that's what I have chosen to be my, you know, my center. So I guess personally, there have just been a few things that I feel like I have tried to cultivate and develop over the past couple of years. Mostly it's within my family right now. You know, personally and within my family, it hasn't really filtered that far into my community yet. Hopefully it will. I think that's something that hopefully will happen. But I've tried, and I think that the things that have impacted me most over the past couple of years have been the things that are embedded with, again, the most layers of reality or meaning. You know, and you think of Christ as being the ultimate symbol, where everything is concentrated in him, and he fills the hierarchy, he fills all levels of, you know, from the dust down to the highest spiritual aspect of things. And so just taking kind of that model and trying to apply it to different areas of my life has been incredible. And I think of things that we have so disintegrated from each other. So in one aspect, we try and force ourselves to exercise and eat right because we know it's good for us, but it's separated from our lives as Christians, our connection with the earth, with our bodies, with each other. They're so fragmented out. And so it's difficult to be consistent with things like that. Like exercise for me has just been something that I've had trouble having it be a regular part of what I do, because it just has felt like this thing off to the side that doesn't connect. And so I told you this story, I think, of me just last year when I was trying to connect with the farm and feeling really separated from, you know, my husband's family. And so I just, part of this was, okay, so I know I need to exercise. I know I need to connect with this farm and feel like it's a part of me and I'm a part of it. And just feel more grounded and rooted. And so in a very literalistic way, walking the grass with my bare feet, making a path in the backyard, accomplished all of these things. And it condensed them all into this one act that, even though you'd say, well, walking around in the grass, that's not very much exercise. And yet, because of the symbolism of what happened during those walks, and again, I could go on and on about the ways that God spoke to me through that act, has then allowed me to actually continue with being consistent, say in exercise, since then. And so it's like, it was a very small thing. And I think Peterson's mantra of, you know, starting with the tiniest little thing that you think is maybe insignificant, and then building up from there, because we have these high ideals, and I've always started these big, you know, exercise regimes with, you know, all of this complicated stuff, and you never stick with it.
You're an idealist.
Exactly. And so, you know, that is one thing that I've just seen. Okay, so I know I start these habits, these patterns, but, you know, I seem to fail. But I've noticed that if it's tied to these different layers and levels of meaning, that it sticks, and it actually it's actually something that I remember with gratitude and with, you know, a sense of me being embedded in the whole story of Christianity, all of these things. And this is kind of, you know, filtered into other areas of my life. You know, I play piano. My kids are just starting to learn piano. So we've tried to integrate, you know, singing together. And then my daughter, she's making up these little melodies. And so I would go and sit down and add to her song. And she, you know, I did this the other day. She started just crying because she thought it was so amazing, you know, and just stuff like that. And then like we're doing a project, again, this is very practical stuff, but doing a project with our, with my kids, homeschool, art stuff. And it was their aunt's birthday. And so I'm thinking, well, how can I embed as much meaning into this art project and use it as a gift? And so we ended up going around the farmyard and finding things that we crushed up and made paint. And then we actually, together, we painted this picture that, you know, that actually in the, you know, in the design of the painting held the actual particles of leaves and flowers that we found outside. And this is my husband's sister who we gave it to, who really loves this farm. And so, I mean, again, these things seem really, really easy and simple, and yet they're not. And
they don't seem easy and simple. They are hard, but it's incredibly rich. I know many people who listening to this would say, I'd kill to have this woman's life. because you're mapping out. I mean, you've got, just got so many elements right there and you're doing it.
Yeah. Well, I feel like
now you're an idealist. It's never going to be enough, but go ahead.
You know, I think just having, it's hard because I tend to kind of want a list of things to do. So follow this, follow these guidelines, or even, you know, do these specific things. And that's just not how life is. But I think having that, it's again, it's the patterns, right? It's the forms of things that, that you put your particularness, your particularity into. But that, just that idea of compressing and condensing and adding all the layers of meaning, you know, getting up early, I've struggled with, but the past couple of months I've just been getting up, you know, even like prayer and things that, that I was never really taught how to do growing up in evangelicalism. It's always this spontaneous talking to God, but yet it always kind of felt like a performance to me. I felt like I was more worried about what I was saying and how I was saying it than actually communicating. So incorporating things like, you know, like Lectio Divina and examine practices have been so incredibly, such a blessing to me. And it's like, it's made me excited about getting up early. I'll light a candle and, you know, even like listening to an app that I found on the Discord that someone had posted that just walks you through, you know, meditating on scripture and things like that. So it accomplishes so many things within that even 10 minutes of time. And I've been able to actually be consistent with it for the first time ever and want to do it. So I guess to just kind of wrap that up, I would ask you, like what would you add to that? Like, how do we practice, how do we make these glory making practices, say beyond, I mean, I think I've kind of figured it out in my family to a certain degree, or at least a direction. How does that filter out into community, and how do we kind of do what Verveke's been talking about wanting to do, but on a practical scale, and say within the church, within someone who is in a situation like me, where, you know, there's not a bunch of setup of practices, there's not that structure. So what would you say?
Number one, you already improved your point. Number two, it shouldn't be fuller integration of Christianity into all areas of life. It should be fuller integration of Christ into all areas of life. Mm-hmm. A second point, the Pentecostalism lack of the Pentecostal spontaneous prayer was a reaction to the Lectio Divina that you are now finding life in. And so probably what you are in the process of doing is just integrating both of those things. Mm-hmm. And that is, as you learned the piano, you both needed to have a lot of practice to get mastery of basics. And once you had mastery of the basics, you could then do, as you demonstrated to your daughter so beautifully, how once you get skill, like mastery, you can take a little thing like your daughter's, the little spontaneous thing that your daughter did, which is just this beginning of a spontaneous prayer, and you can wrap so much around it that it can be something far more. And that's, and what you did with your daughter in that moment was one of the best images of glory you're going to find, because that's exactly what happens. That's exactly our relationship with God in terms of us being glory makers. And I think in many ways, the project that John Verbeke is working on, you don't need, because you already have so many of the elements that he is trying to create. And this is something that a lot of the Christians who are, say, looking at Verbeke through me and expressing frustration, part of it is that many Christians are so living within even the frustrating riches of their sparse evangelical environments. When I listen to Verbeke, he is adding academic, cognitive science, and philosophical language to stuff that the church has been practicing forever. And so if you've been deeply embedded in the church, you know, it's sort of like, it's sort of like someone who's been eating healthy all their life, because someone 500 years ago who's living on a farm, actually a very well-functioning farm, there's nothing inorganic about anything they're touching. It's like telling them to eat organic. They're like, that's all I got is organic. You know, the fixation of nitrogen hasn't happened yet at the beginning of the 20th century. So, you know, I think the Verbeke stuff is really important and helpful for people who have been in the blast zone of secularity and the wasteland, the devastation of the wasteland is simply too much to bear, and they are looking for wisdom practices and community, and you know, they can add Latin words to this stuff, but it's all the stuff that you have in Christ and the church already. Now you're dealing with the stuff that they dealt with in the past now on the front end, and that's sort of what happens as churches go into the future in this way. But you know, to me it sounds like, and I'm sort of course, it's not great comfort to hear it, but you know, you're doing well. You're doing what you need to be doing. Keep doing it. It's frustrating, I know, but ask yourself some of these days, okay, really, if I were to sit down, this is always the challenge for an idealist. If I were to sit down and draw out my perfect day, you might, first of all, notice that you've had that day already a number of times. And part of the thing that made that day so great is you didn't have your fingers all over it. It was enchanted. It was a gift of God. And that's the irony of idealism, is that on one hand you say, tell me how I can secure exactly what I'm looking for every day. And on the other hand, we begin the conversation saying, I want an enchanted world. The whole essence of enchantment is that it's this gift of grace that comes from a mysterious place and lands upon you with delight. That's completely the opposite of an answer that tells you how to reproduce what you're looking for in a factory basis.
Yeah.
So
exactly.
The contradictions are already pre-built into your frustration. And I wish we had another hour, but I got someone waiting for me now.
That is okay. I think I got out what I wanted to say, and you gave me some good feedback. So it was lovely.
Well, you know, and here's the thing too. your children are growing up in the midst of this. For mm-hmm. you, this is your story, complete with all sorts of frustration. 20 yeah. years from now, you're going to look back on these moments and say, wow, those were magical, because mm-hmm. they are. And you're so deeply embedded in it with, you know, now another child on the way and the smallness of your children and homeschooling. It's crazy making, difficult, hard, frustrating. 20 years from now, it'll be glory days. Mm-hmm. This is the enchanted world of your children, and they're going to grow up saying things. You know, when we were growing up, I made this little tune and mom made this beautiful thing around it. And we found stuff to paint with from the farm. And you are giving your children an enormous gift that they can't yet appreciate, but they will. And you will someday appreciate it too. So keep struggling, keep doing what you're doing. But to me, when you say you haven't left your church, that's a really good sign that you're doing it right, because you're working the tension of the kite. You're staying, you're the wind is pulling you, and you're looking to grow, and you're going to grow your children and the people around you, but you're not just selflessly abandoning everything that you're tied to in order to chase some dream. Because so often when people do that, it's like the kite rolling around on the field and yep. it accomplishes nothing. There's no glory in it and it destroys itself. So, mm-hmm. you know, and you're doing lots of stuff wrong too. I'm sure of that, because you're a human being, but it sounds to me like you're really doing well. And so I just want to encourage you and say, keep working it, keep working it. You're doing great.
All right. Well, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Hey, Sarah, I'll send this to you.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.